Disc 6.
Hook, is that you?
Sir Edward, Hook said. He laid the crossbow on the floor and stood smiling.
It is you.
Sir Edward Derwent, Lord Slayton's man who in London had saved Hook from the Manor Court and its inevitable punishment, was smiling back in the dirty light.
I heard you were here, he said. How are you?
Still alive, Sir Edward, Hook said, grinning.
God be praised for that, though God knows how anyone survives down here.
Sir Edward, his scar-ravaged face, half hidden by his helmet, listened to the ominous noises.
They sound close.
We think they are, Hook said.
It's deceptive, Daffod Aptrahan put in. They could be 10 paces away still. It's hard to tell with sounds underground.
So, they could be a hand's breadth away, Sir Edward inquired sourly.
Or they could be, the Welshman said dourly.
Sir Edward looked at the drawn crossbows. And the idea is to welcome them with bolts, he asked, then kill the bastards.
The idea is to keep me alive, Daffod Aptrahan said. And you're blocking the tunnel, you are. There are too many of you. There's work to be done.
Sir John's men-at-arms had already gone, and now Hook sent his archers after them. He lingered a moment.
I wish you a quiet night, he said to Sir Edward. Dear God, I echo that prayer, Sir Edward said. He grinned. It's good to see you, Hook.
Pleasure to see you, sir, Hook said. And thank you.
Go and rest, man, Sir Edward said.
Hook nodded. He hefted his poleaxe and, with a farewell nod to Daffod Aptrahan, edged past Sir Edward's men, one of whom tried to trip him, and Hook saw the lantern jaw and sunken eyes, and for a moment in the half-darkness he thought it was Sir Martin, then realised it was the priest's elder son, Tom Peril. Both brothers were there, stooping under the beams, but Hook ignored them, knowing that neither would attack him while Sir Edward was present. He trudged up the tunnel towards the fading daylight far ahead. He was thinking of Melisande, of the stew she would have ready, and of songs around the campfire when the world shattered. Noise thudded about his ears. It started as a thunderous growl that billowed just behind him, and there was a rending noise as though the earth itself was splitting apart, and he turned to see dust boiling towards him. A dark cloud of dust rolling in the shaft's dark light, and men like monstrous shadows were lumbering in that darkness. There was shouting, the sound of steel on armour, and a scream. The first scream. The French had broken through. Hook instinctively stared back towards the fighting, then remembered the barrels and wondered if he should block the tunnel's entrance. He hesitated. A man was screeching from the dark, a horrible noise, like the sound of a clumsily gelded beast. There was another rumbling, and Hook had a glimpse of more men dropping from the tunnel's roof, then more dust surging towards him, obliterating his sight. But in the dust, a figure lurched towards him. It was a man-at-arms, sword drawn. His visor was closed. He held his sword two-handed, and somehow the dust and half-light made him look like some enormous earth giant come from Nightmare's bowels. His plate armour was coated in chalk and earth, and Hook stared, petrified by the unnatural vision. But then the man bellowed, and that sound startled Hook to reality, just as the man-at-arms lunged the sword at his belly. Hook twisted to one side and rammed the poleaxe straight at the steel-shrouded face. The spear point slid off the pig-snouted visor, but the top edge of the heavy hammer cracked into the helmet, crushing the metal. Hook had used all his archer's strength in that blow, and the earth giant reeled backwards, blood welling from his visor's holes, and Hook remembered all those lessons in Sir John's meadows, and closed on the man fast, getting inside the sword's reach so the enemy could not swing the blade, and he rammed the poleaxe like a quarterstaff driving the man down onto the floor. Hook had no room to swing the poleaxe, but strength made up for that, and he slammed the axe blade onto the man's sword elbow, breaking it, then slid the spear point into the gap between the enemy's helmet and breastplate. The Frenchman wore an avantail, a mail hood, to protect that gap, but the steel spike ripped easily through the links and gouged into the man's throat. And then more men were coming towards Hook as the earth giant, shrunken to normal size now, writhed on the mine floor where his blood spilt into the chalk, black draining into white. The men coming up the tunnel were fighting each other. Hook dragged the blade free of the dying earth giant and rammed the spear point at a man in a strange surcoat. The blade glanced off plate armour, ripping the coat, and the man turned, beast-faced visor pointing at Hook and brought his sword around, but it caught on one of the mine's timber supports, and Hook lunged again with the poleaxe, this time hooking the axe blade around the man's ankle, and then pulling hard so that the Frenchman lost his balance. A Welsh miner staggered towards Hook, guts spilling from an open belly. Hook shouldered him aside and pushed the spear point under the fallen man's breastplate, the gap just visible through the torn linen. He pushed and twisted the long haft, trying to drive the blade up into the man's stomach and chest, but something blocked the blade, and then another rush of men pushing him backwards. They were Lord Slayton's men, retreating from the French, though a handful of the enemy was among them. Men wrestled in the dark, tripped over the dead and the dying, and slipped in sewage. Two men-at-arms forced Hook back against the side of the tunnel, and he again thrust the poleaxe like a quarterstaff two-handed, but a rush of men pushed his enemies aside as archers and miners fled to the sow.
"Hold them!"
Sir Edward's voice bellowed from further down the mine. The barrels, Hook momentarily free of enemies, turned and ran towards the mine entrance. He made it to where the shaft sloped gently up towards the surface, but there a foot tripped him and he sprawled heavily onto the chalk. He twisted aside and tried to climb to his feet, but a boot kicked him in the belly. Hook twisted again to see Tom and Robert Peril standing over him.
"Quick!" Tom Peril shouted at his brother.
Robert lifted a sword, point downwards, aimed at Hook's throat.
"I'll have your woman," Tom Peril said, though Hook could scarcely hear him over the shouts and screams echoing up the tunnel.
More shouts sounded from the sow, where attackers fought a bitter, sudden battle against startled defenders. Then Robert Peril's sword came down, and Hook rolled again, throwing himself against his enemy's feet, and he heaved up so that Robert Peril tumbled against the far wall, and the poleaxe was still in Hook's hand as he scrambled to his feet and turned on Thomas Peril, who simply ran away.
"Coward!"
Hook shouted, and looked down to Robert, who was flailing the sword uselessly and screaming, screaming, and Hook suddenly understood why. The earth was quivering as another scream, thin as a blade, sounded in Hook's ears.
"Down!" St. Crispinian said.
And the earth was shaking now, and the thin scream was lost in thunder, only the thunder was not from the sky, but from the earth, and Hook obeyed the saint, crouching down beside Robert Peril as the tunnel roof collapsed. It seemed to last forever. Timbers cracked, the noise groaned and boomed, and the earth fell. Hook closed his eyes. The thin scream was back, but it was inside his head. It was fear, his own scream, his terror of death. He was breathing dust. At the last day he knew the dead would rise from the earth. They would come from their graves, the earth making way for their flesh and bones, and they would face east towards the shining holy city of Jerusalem, and the sky in the east would be brighter than the sun, and a great terror would swamp the newly resurrected dead as they stood in their winding sheets. There would be screaming and crying, folk flinching from the sudden dazzle of new light, but all the dead priests of the parish would have been buried with their feet towards the west, so that when they rose from their tombs, they would face their frightened congregations and could call out reassurance. And for some reason, as the earth collapsed to make Hook's grave, he thought of Sir Martin and wondered whether that twisted, sour, long-jawed face would be the first he would see on the last day when trumpets filled the heavens and God came in glory to take his people. A roof timber slammed down and the earth fell, and Hook was crouched and the thunder was all around him, and the scream in his head died to a whimper. And then there was silence. Sudden, utter, black silence. Hook breathed.
"Oh God!"
Robert Peril moaned. Something pressed on Hook's back. It was heavy and seemed immovable, but it was not crushing him. The darkness was absolute.
"Oh God, please!"
Peril said. The earth shuddered again, and there was a muffled bang. A gun, Hook thought, and now he could even hear voices, but they were very far off. His mouth was full of grit. He spat. The poleaxe was still in Hook's right hand, but he could not move it. The weapon was trapped by something. He let go of it and felt around him, conscious that he was in a small, tight space. His fingers groped across Peril's head.
"Help me!"
Peril said. Hook said nothing. He felt behind him and realized a roof timber had half fallen and somehow left this small space where he crouched and breathed. The timber slanted down, and it was that rough oak that was pressing into his spine.
"What do I do?" he asked aloud. "You're not far from the surface," St. Crispinian said.
"You must help me,"
Peril said.
If I move, I die, Hook thought.
Nick, help me,
Peril said.
Please.
Just push up, St. Crispinian said. Show some courage, St. Crispin said in his harsher voice.
For God's sake, help me,
Peril moaned.
Move to your right, St. Crispinian said, and don't be frightened.
Hook moved slowly. Earth fell.
Now dig your way out, St. Crispinian said. Like a mole.
Moles die, Hook said, and he wanted to explain how they trap moles by blocking their tunnels and then digging out the frightened animals, but the saint did not want to listen.
You're not going to die, the saint said impatiently. Not if you dig.
So Hook pushed upwards, scrabbling at the earth with both hands, and the soil caved in, filling his mouth, and he wanted to scream, but he could not scream. And he pushed with his legs, using all the strength in his body, and the earth collapsed around him, and he was certain he would die here, except that suddenly, quite suddenly, he was breathing clean air. His grave had been very shallow, nothing but a shroud of fallen soil, and he was half standing in open air and was astonished to discover that full night had not yet fallen. It seemed to be raining, except the sky was clear, and then he realized the French were shooting crossbow bolts from the barbican and from the half-wrecked walls. They were not shooting at him, but at men peering from the English trenches and around the edges of the sow. Hook was up to his waist in earth. He reached down beside his right leg and took hold of Robert Peril's leather jerkin. He pulled, and the earth was loose enough to let him drag the choking archer up into the last of the daylight. A crossbow bolt thumped into the soil a few inches from Hook, and he went very still. He was in what looked like a crude trench, and the high sides of the trench gave him some protection from the French bolts. The town's defenders were cheering. They had seen the tunnels collapse and they saw the English trying to rescue anyone who might have survived the catastrophe, and so they were filling the twilight with crossbow bolts to drive those rescuers back.
Oh, God!
Robert Peril sighed.
You're alive, Hook said.
Nick!
We have to wait, Hook said.
Robert Peril choked and spat out earth.
Wait!
Can't move till dark, Hook said. They're shooting at us.
My brother!
He ran away, Hook said.
He wondered what had happened to Sir Edward. Had that deeper part of the mine collapsed, or had the French killed all the men in the tunnel? The enemy had driven their own shaft above the English excavation and then dropped into the tunnel, and Hook imagined the sudden fight, the death in the darkness and the pain of the dying in the ready-made grave.
You were going to kill me, he said to Robert Peril.
Peril said nothing. He was half lying on the trench floor, but his legs were still buried. He'd lost his sword.
You were going to kill me, Hook said again.
My brother was.
You held the sword, Hook said.
Peril wiped dirt from his face.
I'm sorry, Nick,
he said. Hook snorted, said nothing.
Sir Martin said he'd pay us,
Peril admitted.
Your father, Hook sneered.
Peril hesitated, then nodded.
Yes.
Because he hates me.
Your mother rejected him,
Peril said. Hook laughed.
And your mother whored herself, he said flatly.
He told her she'd go to heaven, Peril said. That if you do it with a priest, you go to heaven. That's what he said.
He's mad, Hook said flatly. Moon-touched mad.
Peril ignored that.
He gave her money. He still does. And he'll give us money.
To kill me?
Hook asked, though the French were trying hard enough to save Sir Martin the trouble. The crossbow bolts were thudding and spitting, some tumbling end over end down the crude trench made by the collapsed tunnel.
He wants your woman,
Robert Peril said.
How much is he paying you?
A mark each,
Peril said, eager to help Hook now. A mark, 160 pennies, or 320 pence if both brothers were paid, 53 days pay for an archer. The price of Hook's life and Melisande's misery.
So, you have to kill me, Hook asked. Then take my girl.
He wants that.
He's an evil mad bastard, Hook said.
He can be kind,
Peril said pathetically.
Do you remember John Lottock's daughter?
Of course I remember her.
He took her away, but he paid John in the end, gave him the girl's dowry.
£160 for raping her?
No! Peril was puzzled by the question. I think it was £2. Might have been more. John was happy.
The light was fading fast now. The French had saved their loaded guns for the moment when their countermine pierced the English tunnel, and now they fired shot after shot from Harfleur's walls. The smoke billowed like thunderclouds to darken the already dark sky as the gunstone bounced and thudded off the sow's stout flanks.
Robert!
A voice shouted from the sow.
That's Tom!
Robert Peril said, recognizing his brother's voice. He took a breath to call back, but Hook stopped his mouth with a hand.
Keep quiet, Hook snarled.
A crossbow bolt tumbled down the trench and smacked into Hook's mail. It had lost its force and bounced away as another bolt struck sparks from a lump of flint nearby.
What happens now? Hook asked, taking his hand away from Robert Peril's mouth.
What do you mean?
I take you back and you try and kill me again.
No,
Peril said.
Get me out of here, Nick. I can't move.
So what happens now? Hook asked again.
Crossbow bolts were cracking into the sow so frequently that it sounded like hail on a timber roof.
I won't kill you, Peril said.
What should I do? Hook asked.
Pull me out, Nick, please,
Peril said. I wasn't talking to you. What should I do?
What do you think?
St. Crispin, the harsher brother, said in a mocking voice.
It's murder, Hook said.
I won't kill you,
Peril insisted.
You think we saved the girl so she could be raped?
St. Crispinian asked.
Get me out of this muck, Peril said. Please!
Instead, Hook reached out and found one of the spent crossbow bolts. It was as long as his forearm, as thick as two thumbs and fledged with stiff leather veins. The point was rusted but still sharp. He killed Peril the easiest way. He smacked him hard around the head, and while the archer was still recovering from the blow, drove the bolt down through one eye. It went in easily, glancing off the socket, and Hook kept driving the thick shaft into Peril's brain until the rusted point scraped against the back of Peril's skull. The archer twisted and jerked, choked and quivered, but he died quickly enough.
Robert!
Tom Peril shouted from the sow. A springalt bolt struck a masonry chimney breast left standing in the scorched remains of a burned house. The bolt sprung into the falling darkness end over end, soaring over the English trenches to fall far beyond. Hook wiped his wounded right hand on Robert Peril's tunic, cleaning off the muck that had spurted from the dead man's eye, then heaved himself free of the soil. It was very nearly night, and the smoke of the gunshot still shrouded what little light remained. He stepped over Peril and staggered towards the sow, his legs slow to find their strength again. Crossbow bolts flicked past him, but their aim was wild now, and Hook reached the sow safely. He held onto its flank as he walked, then dropped into the safety of the trench. Lanterns lit his dirt-crusted face and men stared at him.
How many others survived?
A man-at-arms asked.
Don't know, Hook said.
Here!
A priest brought him a pot and Hook drank. He'd not realized how thirsty he was until he tasted the ale.
My brother!
Thomas Peril was among the men staring at Hook.
Killed by a crossbow bolt, Hook said curtly and stared up into Peril's long face. Straight through the eye, he added brutally.
Peril stared at him, and then Sir John Cornwell pushed through the small crowd in the sow's pit.
Hook!
I'm alive, Sir John.
You don't look it. Come!
Sir John grasped Hook's arm and led him towards the camp.
What happened?
They came from above, Hook said. I was on my way out when the roof fell in.
It fell on you?
Yes, Sir John.
Someone loves you, Hook.
St. Crispinian does, Hook said.
Then he saw Melisande in the light of a campfire and went to her embrace. And afterwards, in the darkness, had nightmares. Sir John's men started dying next morning. A man-at-arms and two archers, all three of them struck by the sickness that turned bowels into sewers of filthy water. Alice Godwin died. A dozen other men-at-arms were sick, as were at least 20 archers. The army was being ravaged by the plague and the stench of shit hung over the camp, and the French built their walls higher every night, and in the dawn men struggled to the gun pits and trenches, where they vomited and voided their bowels. Father Christopher caught the sickness. Melisande found him shivering in his tent, face pale, lying in his own filth and too weak to move.
"I ate some nuts," he told her.
"Nuts?"
"Les noix,"
he explained in a voice that was like a breathless groan.
"I didn't know."
"Didn't know?"
"The doctors tell me now that you shouldn't eat nuts or cabbage. Not with the sickness about. I ate nuts."
Melisande washed him.
"You'll make me sicker,"
he complained, but was too weak to prevent her from cleaning him. She found him a blanket, though Father Christopher threw it off when the day's warmth became insufferable. Much of the lowland in which Harfleur stood was still flooded, and the heat seemed to shimmer off the shallow water and made the air thick as steam. The gun still fired, but less frequently because the Dutch gunners had also been struck by the murrain. No one was spared. Men in the king's household fell ill, great lords were struck down, and the angels of death hovered on dark wings above the English camp. Melisande found blackberries and begged some barley from Sir John's cooks. She boiled the berries and barley to reduce the liquid, that she then sweetened with honey and spooned into Father Christopher's mouth.
"I'm going to die," he told her weakly.
"No," she said decisively, "you are not." The king's own physician, Master Colnett, came to Father Christopher's tent. He was a young, serious man with a pale face and a small nose, with which he smelt Father Christopher's feces. He offered no judgment on what he had determined from the odours. Instead, he briskly opened a vein in the priest's arm and bled him copiously.
"The girl's ministrations will do no harm," he said.
"God bless her,"
Father Christopher said weakly.
"The king sent you wine," Master Colnett said.
"Thank his majesty for me."
"It's excellent wine," Colnett said, binding the cut arm with practiced skill. "Though it didn't help the bishop."
"Bangor's dead?"
"Not Bangor, Norwich. He died yesterday."
"Dear God," Father Christopher said.
"I bled him too," Master Colnett said, "and thought he would live, but God decreed otherwise. I shall come back tomorrow."
The Bishop of Norwich's body was cut into quarters, then boiled in a giant cauldron to flench the flesh from the bones. The filthy steaming liquid was poured away and the bones were wrapped in linen and nailed in a coffin that was carried to the shore so the bishop could be taken home to be buried in the diocese he had taken such care to avoid in life. Most of the dead were simply dropped into pits dug wherever there was a patch of ground high enough to hold an unflooded grave. But as more men died, the grave pits were abandoned and the corpses were carried to the tidal flats and thrown into the shallow creeks, where they were at the mercy of wild dogs, gulls, and eternity. The stench of the dead and the stink of shit and the reek of smouldering fires filled the encampment. 2 mornings after Hook had stumbled away from the fallen mine, there was a sudden flurry of gunshots from the walls of Harfleur. The garrison had loaded their cannon and now fired them all at the same time so that the battered town was edged with smoke. Defenders cheered from the walls and waved derisive flags.
"A ship got through to them," Sir John explained.
"A ship?" Hook asked.
"For Christ's sake, you know what a ship is."
"But how?"
"Our goddamn fleet was asleep, that's how. Now the goddamn bastards have got food. Goddamn the bastards."
It seemed God had changed sides, for the defences of Harfleur, though battered and broken, were constantly replenished and rebuilt. New walls backed the broken old, and every night the garrison deepened the defensive ditch and raised new obstacles in the shattered breaches. The intensity of the crossbow bolts did not let up, proof that the town had been well stocked, or else that the ship that had evaded the blockade had brought a new supply. The English, meanwhile, grew more ill. Sir John ducked into Father Christopher's tent and stared at the priest.
"How is he?" he asked Melisande.
She shrugged. As far as Hook could tell, the priest was already dead, for he lay unmoving on his back, his mouth slackly open and his skin greyish pale.
"Is he breathing?" Sir John demanded.
Melisande nodded.
"God help us," Sir John said, and backed out of the tent. "God help us," he said again, and stared at the town.
It should have fallen 2 weeks ago, yet there it lay, defiant still, the wreckage of its wall and towers protecting the new barricades that had been built behind. There was some good news. Sir Edward Derwent was a prisoner in Harfleur, as was David Ap Trahan, The heralds returning from another vain attempt to persuade the garrison to surrender told how the men trapped in the mine's far end had surrendered. The collapsed mine had been abandoned, though on Arflur's eastern side, where the king's brother led the siege, other shafts were still being driven towards the walls. The best news was that the French were making no effort to relieve the town. English patrols were riding far into the countryside to find grain, and there was no sign of an enemy army coming to strike at the disease-weakened English. Arflur, it seemed, had been left to rot, though it appeared now that the besiegers would be destroyed first.
"All that money," Sir John said bleakly, "and all we've done is march a couple of miles to become lords of graves and shit pits."
"So why don't we just leave it?" Hook asked. "Just march away?"
"A goddamn stupid question," Sir John said. "The place might surrender tomorrow, and all Christendom is watching. If we abandon the siege, we look weak. Besides, even if we did march inland, we won't necessarily find the French. They've learned to fear English armies, and they know the quickest way to get rid of us is to hide themselves in fortresses. So we might just abandon this siege to start another. No, we have to take this goddamn town."
"Then why don't we attack?" Hook asked.
"Because we'll lose too many men," Sir John said. "Imagine it, Hook. Crossbows, springalts, guns, all tearing into us as we advance, killing us while we fill the ditch. And then we get over the wall's rubble to find a new ditch, a new wall, and more crossbows, more guns, more catapults. We can't afford to lose 100 dead and 400 crippled. We came here to conquer France, not die in this rancid shithole."
He kicked at the hard ground, then stared at the sea where 6 English ships lay at anchor off the harbour entrance.
"If I commanded Arflur's garrison," he said ruefully, "I know just what I'd do now."
"What's that?"
"Attack," Sir John said. "Kick us while we're half crippled. We speak of chivalry, Hook, and we are chivalrous. We fight so politely. Yet you know how to win a battle."
"Fight dirty, Sir John."
"Fight filthy, Hook. Fight like the devil and send chivalry to hell. He's no fool."
"The devil?" Sir John shook his head.
"No, Raoul de Gaucourt. He commands the garrison." Sir John nodded towards Arflur. "He's a gentleman, Hook, but he's also a fighter, and he's no fool. And if I were Raoul de Gaucourt, I'd kick the shit out of us right now."
And next day, Raoul de Gaucourt did.
"Wake up, Nick!"
It was Thomas Evelgold bellowing at him. The sentinel slapped Hook's shelter, shaking it so hard that scraps of dead leaves and pieces of turf fell onto Hook and Melisande.
"God damn you, wake up!"
Evelgold shouted again. Hook opened his eyes to darkness.
"Tom?" he called.
But Evelgold had already moved on to wake other archers. A second voice was shouting for the men to assemble.
"Armour! Weapons! Hurry! God damn now! I want you all here, now! Now!"
"What is it?" Melisande asked.
"Don't know," Hook said. He fumbled to find his mail coat. The stink of the leather lining was overpowering as he pulled it over his head. He forced the unwieldy garment down his chest.
"Sword belt."
"Kia."
Melisande was kneeling. The campfires were being revived, and their flames reflected red from her wide open eyes. Hook put on a short surcoat with its cross of St. George, the badge that every man was required to wear in the siege works. He pulled on his boots, the once good boots that he had bought in Soissons, but which were now coming apart at the seams. He strapped on his belt, slid the bow from its cover, and snatched up an arrow bag. He had tied a long leather strap to the poleaxe, and he slung that over his shoulder, then ducked into the night.
"I'll be back," he called to Melisande.
"Casque!" she shouted after him. "Casque!"
He reached back and took the helmet from her. He felt a sudden urge to tell her he loved her, but Melisande had disappeared back into the shelter, and Hook said nothing. He sensed the night was ending. The stars were pale, which meant dawn would soon stain the sky above the obstinate city. But ahead of him, there was tumult. The flames in the siege works leapt higher, casting grotesque shadows across the broken ground.
"Come to me! Come to me!" Sir John was shouting beside the largest campfire.
The archers were gathering quickly, but the men-at-arms, who needed more time to buckle on their plate armour, were slower to arrive. Sir John had chosen to forego his expensive plate armour and was dressed like the archers in mail coat and jupon.
"Evelgold, Hook, Maggot, Candler, Brute," Sir John called.
Walter Maggot, Pierce Candler, and Thomas Brute were the other three Ventoners.
"Here, Sir John," Evelgold responded.
"Bastards have made a sally," Sir John said urgently.
That explained the shouting and the sound of the steel clashing with steel that came from the forward trenches. Arfleur's garrison had sallied out to attack the sow and gun pits.
"We have to kill the bastards," Sir John said. "We're going to attack straight down to the sow. Some of us are, but not you, Hook. You know the savage?"
"Yes, Sir John," Hook said, adjusting the buckle of his sword belt. The savage was a catapult, a great wooden beast that hurled stones into Arfleur, and, of all the siege engines, it lay closest to the sea at the right-hand end of the English lines.
"Take your men there," Sir John said, "and work your way in towards the sow. Got that?"
"Yes, Sir John," Hook said again. He strung the bow by bracing one end on the ground and looped the cord over the upper nock.
"Then go! Go now!" Sir John snarled. "And kill the bastards!"
He turned.
"Where's my banner? I want my banner! Bring me my goddamn banner!"
Hook led 16 men now. It should have been 23, but 7 were either dead or ill. He wondered how 17 men were supposed to fight their way along trenches and gun pits, swarming with an enemy who had sallied from the Lure Gate. It was evidence the French had captured large stretches of the siege works because, as Hook led his men down the southwards track, he could see more fire springing up in the English gun pits and the shapes of men scurrying in front of those flames. Groups of men-at-arms and archers crossed Hook's path, all going towards the fighting. Hook could hear the clash of blades now.
"What do we do, Nick?"
Will of the Dales asked.
"You heard, Sir John. Start at the savage, work our way in," Hook said, and was surprised that he sounded confident.
Sir John's orders had been vague and given hurriedly, and Hook had simply obeyed by leading his men towards the savage, but only now was he trying to work out what he was supposed to do. Sir John was assembling his men-at-arms and had kept most of the archers, presumably for an attack on the sow that seemed to have fallen into the enemy's possession. But why detach Hook? Because, Hook decided, Sir John needed flank protection. Sir John and his men were the beaters, and they would drive the game across Hook's front, where the archers could cut them down. Hook, recognizing the plan's simplicity, felt a surge of pride. Sir John could have sent his sentinel Tom Evelgold or any of the other Ventoners, all of whom were older and more senior, but Sir John had chosen Hook. Fires burned at the savage, but they had not been set by the French. They were the campfires of the men who guarded the pit in which the catapult sat, and their flames lit the monstrously gaunt beams of the giant engine. A dozen archers, the sentries who guarded the machine, through the night waited with strung bows, and as they saw men coming down the slope, turned those bows towards Hook.
"St. George!" Hook bellowed. "St. George!"
The bows dropped. The sentries were nervous.
"What's happening?"
one of them demanded of Hook.
"French are out."
"I know, but what's happening?"
"I don't know," Hook snapped, then turned to count his men.
He did it in the old way of the country, like a shepherd counting his flock, just as his father had taught him.
Yain, Tain, Edero, he counted and got to Bumfit, which was 15, and looked for the extra man and saw 2. Tain a Bumfit.
Then he saw the 17th man was short and slight and carried a crossbow.
"For God's sake, girl, go back," he called. And then he forgot Melisande because Tom Scarlet shouted a warning and Hook whipped around to see a band of men running towards the savage down the wide trench that snaked to the catapult from the nearest gun pit. Some of the approaching men carried torches that streamed sparks and the bright flames reflected from helmets, swords and axes.
"No crosses," Tom Scarlet warned,
meaning that none of the men in the trench was wearing the cross of St. George. They were French, and seeing the archers outlined by the fires burning in the savage's pit, they began shouting their challenge.
"Saint-Denis! Arfleur!"
"Bows!"
Hook shouted, and his men instinctively spread out.
"Kill them!"
he shouted. The range was short, less than 50 paces, and the attackers made themselves into an easy target because they were constricted by the trench's walls. The first arrows drilled into them, and the thuds of the heads striking home instantly silenced the enemy's shouting. The sound of the bows was sharp, each release of the string followed by the briefest fluttering rush as the feathers caught the air. In the darkness, those feathers made small white flickers that stopped abruptly as the arrow slapped home. To Hook, it seemed as if time had slowed. He was plucking arrows from his bag, laying them over the stave, bringing up the bow, hauling the cord, releasing, and he felt no excitement, no fear, and no exhilaration. He knew exactly where each arrow would go before he even pulled it from the bag. He aimed at the approaching men's bellies, and in the flamelight he saw those men doubling over as his arrows struck. The enemy's charge ended as surely as though they had run into a stone wall. The trench was wide enough for six men to walk abreast, and all the leading Frenchmen were on the ground, spitted by arrows, and the men behind tripped on them and in their turn were hit by arrows. Some glanced off plate armour, but others sliced straight through the metal, and even an arrow that failed to pierce the plate had sufficient force to knock a man backwards. If the enemy could have spread out, they might have reached the savage, but the trench walls constricted them, and the feathered bodkins ripped in from the dark, and so the attacking party turned and ran back, leaving a dark mass behind, not all of it motionless.
"Denton, Furnace, Cobbold," Hook called. "Make sure those bastards are dead'uns. The rest of you after me."
The three men jumped into the trench, drew their swords and approached the wounded enemy. Hook, meanwhile, stayed above the trench, advancing beside it with an arrow on his cord. He could see men fighting around the distant sow, and in the wide pit where the biggest gun, the great bombard called the King's Daughter, was dug in. Fire burned bright there, but it was none of Hook's business. His job was to be on Sir John's flank. The ground was rough, churned up by digging and by the strike of French missiles. The boulders slung by the big catapults in Harfleur littered the path, as did the remnants of the houses that had been burned when the siege began. But the dawn was now seeping a faint light in the east, just enough to cast shadows from the obstacles. A crossbow bolt whipped past Hook's head, and he sensed it had come from the nearest gun pit, where a cannon called the Redeemer was emplaced.
"We'll keep those bastards busy."
"What bastards?"
"The ones who've captured the Redeemer," Hook said, and grabbed Will-o'-the-Dale's arm and turned him towards the gun pit, which was a black shadow 20 paces beyond the trench.
It had been protected from the springalts and guns of Harfleur by one of the ingenious wooden screens that loomed high in the darkness, but the tilting screen had not kept the enemy from capturing the cannon.
"Put as many arrows into the pit as you can," Hook told Will, "but stop shooting when we reach the gun."
Hook pushed six men towards Will.
"You obey, Will," he told them. "And you look after Melisande," he added to Will, for she was still with the group. "The rest of you, after me."
Another crossbow bolt hissed close by, but Hook's men were moving fast now. Will-o'-the-Dale and his half-dozen men were moving eastwards to shoot their arrows through the opening at the back of the pit, while Hook was running to the Redeemer's flank. He jumped down into the wide trench and waited for his six men to join him.
"No bows from now on," he told them.
"No bows? We're archers,"
Will Sclate grumbled. Will Sclate always grumbled. He was not a popular man, too morose to be easy company and too slow-witted to join in the incessant chatter among the archers, but he was big and hugely strong. He had grown up on one of Sir John's estates, a labourer's son who might have expected to work the fields his whole life, but Sir John had seen the boy's strength and insisted he learn the longbow. Now, as an archer, he earned far more than any labourer, but he was as slow and stubborn as the clay fields he had once worked with hoe and beetle.
"You're a soldier," Hook snapped at him, "and you're going to use hand weapons."
"What are we doing?"
Geoffrey Horrocks asked. He was the youngest of Sir John's archers, just 17, the son of a falconer.
"We're going to kill some bastards," Hook said.
He slung the bow across his body and hefted the poleaxe instead.
"And we go fast. After me. Now!"
He scrambled up the face of the trench and over the wreckage of the soil-filled wicker baskets that formed the trench's parapet. He could see flamelight in the Redeemer's pit, and he could hear the sharp, thin noise of bowstrings being released from his left where Will-o'-the-Dale's men were lined beside the stone stump of a wrecked chimney. A shout came from the pit, then another, then a screech as an arrowhead scraped against the cannon's flank. Seven archers were shooting into the pit. In 1 minute they could easily loose 60 or 70 arrows, and those arrows were flickering through the half-light, filling the gun pit with hissing death and forcing the French to crouch for protection. Then Hook and his men came at them from the flank. The Frenchmen did not see him because the arrows were whistling and thumping around them, and they were crouching to find what little protection the pit offered. The massive wooden screen gave splendid protection on the face that looked towards Harfleur, but the pit had never been designed to protect men being attacked from the rear, and Will's arrows were streaking down the trench and through the wide gap. Then Hook leapt across the parapet at the pit's side, and he prayed the arrows would stop. They must have stopped, because none of his men was struck by an arrow. The archers were shouting a challenge as they followed Hook over the wicker baskets, and still shouting as they started the killing. Hook was swinging the poleaxe as he landed, and its lead-weighted hammerhead crashed into a crouching Frenchman's helmet, and Hook sensed rather than saw the metal crumpling under the massive blow that collapsed metal skull and brain. A man reared up to his right, but Sklait hurled him back with contemptuous ease as Hook sprawled on the far side of the cannon. He'd leapt clean across the Redeemer's barrel. He hit the far side of the pit hard, lost his footing, and fell heavily. A surge of fear flared cold in his veins. The biggest fear was that he was on the ground and vulnerable. Another, that he might have damaged the bow slung on his back. But later, when he remembered the fight, he realized he'd also felt elation. In memory, it was all a blur of screaming men, bright blades and ringing metal. But in that welter of impressions, there was a cold, hard center in which Nick Hook regained his feet and saw a man at arms at the front of the pit. The man was wearing plate armor, half covered by a surcoat that displayed a red heart pierced by a burning lance. He was holding a sword, his visor was raised, and his eyes reflected the small flames of the fallen torches, and Hook saw fear in those eyes, and Hook felt no pity because of that fear. "Kill or be killed," Sir John always said, and Hook ran at the man, poleaxe levelled, the haft held in both his hands, and he ignored the feeble defensive sword swing the man offered and lunged the spear point at the Frenchman's midriff. The blade scraped off the bottom rim of the breastplate and jarred on the folds, the plate strips worn on a leather skirt designed to stop a sword thrust into the lower belly. But no fold could resist a poleaxe thrust, and Hook saw the man's terrified eyes open wide, and saw his mouth make a great hole as the spear point ripped through steel, leather, male undershirt, skin, muscle and guts to ram against the Frenchman's spine. The man made a mewing noise, and Hook was bellowing a challenge as the thrust pushed his victim back against the gun pit's face. Hook hauled the poleaxe back, and the flailing man came with it, his flesh trapping the point, and Hook put his boot into the mess of blood and armor, braced his leg, and tugged till the blade came free. He lunged it forward again, but checked the blow as the man fell to his knees. Hook whipped around, ready to defend himself, but the fight was already over. There had only been 8 men in the pit. They must have been left there by the larger French party advancing towards the savage, and, when that party had been thrown back by arrows, those 8 had been forgotten. Their job had been to wreck the cannon, a job they had been trying to do with a huge axe that lay abandoned beside the windlass that tilted the heavy protective screen on its massive axle. They had managed to chop the windlass into splinters, but now all but one of them was dead.
"Cornered a cannon with an axe," Tom Scarlett said derisively. The one living Frenchman moaned.
"Anyone hurt?" Hook demanded.
"I twisted my ankle," Horrocks said.
He was panting and his eyes were wide with astonishment or fear.
"You'll mend," Hook said abruptly. "Are we all here?"
His men were all present, and Will-o'-the-Dale was running up the trench with Melisande and his 6 archers. The wounded Frenchman whimpered and drew his legs up. He had been wearing no armour except a padded habergeon, and Will Sklait had driven an axe deep into his chest, so that the linen padding had split out and was now soaked with blood. Hook could see a mess of lungs and splintered ribs. Blood bubbled black from the man's mouth as he moaned again.
"Put him out of his misery," Hook demanded, but his archers just stared at him.
"Oh, for Christ's sake," Hook said.
He stepped over a corpse, put the poleaxe's spike at the man's neck, lunged once, and so did the job himself. Will-o'-the-Dale stared at the carnage in the pit.
"Last time the silly bastards do that," he said.
He tried to speak lightly, imitating Sir John, but there was a squawk in his voice and horror in his eyes. Melisande was close behind Will. She stared dumbly at the dead Frenchman, next at the blood dripping thick from Hook's poleaxe, then up into his eyes.
"You shouldn't be here," he told her harshly.
"I can't stay in the camp," she said. "That priest might come."
"We'll look after her, Nick," Will-o'-the-Dale said,
his voice still strained. He took a step forward and lifted one of the fallen torches, though there was enough light in the east now to make the flames unnecessary.
"Look what they did," he said.
The Frenchmen had used their big axe to chop through the iron bands that hooped the Redeemer's barrel. Hook had not noticed the damage before, but now he saw that two of the metal rings had been hacked clean through, which meant the gun was probably useless because if it was fired, the barrel would expand, split and kill every man in the pit. That was none of Hook's business.
"Search the bastards," he ordered his men.
The three archers who had plundered the bodies of the first French casualties had found silver chains, coins, brooches and a dagger with a jewelled hilt. Those valuables were all in an arrow bag, to which new riches were now added.
"We'll share it out later," Hook decreed. "Now come on, get out of here. Bows."
His bow had been undamaged by his fall. He took it in his left hand, slung the poleaxe on his shoulder, and laid an arrow on the cord. He climbed the pit's side into a grey dawn streaked by dark smoke. In front of him, a battle raged around the sow and around the pit that held the king's daughter. The French had captured both, but the English had streamed from their camp and now outnumbered the raiding party, which was being forced inexorably back. Trumpets blew, the signal for the French to break off their fight and retreat to Harfleur. Flames licked at the sow's heavy timbers and at the swinging screen sheltering the bombard. Men-at-arms were hacking at each other, blades flashing reflected light as they slashed and thrust. Hook looked for Sir John's rampant lion banner and saw it to his left. He saw too that Sir John's men were fighting across the main trench, driving back the large group of French who now formed the attacker's left wing.
"Bows," Hook called.
He hauled the cord back, drawing it to his right ear. The French had been summoned back to the town, but they dared not turn and run for fear of the close English pursuit. And so they were fighting hard, trying to drive Sir John's men back into the trench. They were half facing away from Hook and had no idea that he was on their flank.
"Aim true," Hook shouted, wanting none of his arrows to fall on Englishmen. Then he released, took another bodkin, and that new arrow was only half drawn as the first drove into an enemy's back.
Hook drew full again, saw a Frenchman turn towards the new threat, released, and the arrow slapped into the man's face, and suddenly the enemy was running, defeated by the unexpected attack from their flank. A crossbow bolt flashed in front of Hook. A springle bolt, much larger, churned up a spout of earth as a gun fired from Harfleur's wall. The stone banged into the ground just behind the archers as yet more bolts flickered through the smoke. The crossbow bolts made a fluttering noise, and Hook reckoned their leather fledgings were twisted out of shape, perhaps because they had been badly stored. The bolts were not flying true, but they were still coming too close. Hook glanced at the barbican and saw the enemy crossbowmen taking aim from its summit. He turned and sped an arrow towards them, then called to his men,
"Stop shooting! Get to the trench!"
The French were retreating fast now, but they had done what they had set out to do, which was to damage the siege works. Three of the cannon, including the king's daughter, would never fire again, and all along the trenches parapets had been thrown down and men killed. And now, from the broken ramparts, the defenders jeered at the English as the returning raiding parties negotiated the deep ditch in front of the broken barbican. Arrows still followed the French, and some men were struck and slid into the ditch's bottom, but the sally had been a success. The English works burned, and the garrison's insults stung.
"Bastards," Sir John was saying repeatedly. "They caught us sleeping, the bastards."
"The savage isn't touched," Hook reported stoically, "but they broke the Redeemer."
"We'll break them, the goddamn bastards," Sir John said.
"And none of us was hurt," Hook added.
"We'll hurt them, by Christ," Sir John vowed.
His face was twisted by anger. The siege was already bogged down, but now the enemy had delivered another hard blow to the English hopes. Sir John shuddered as an enemy man-at-arms taken prisoner was ushered down the trench. For a heartbeat, it looked as though Sir John would unleash his fury on the hapless man. But then he saw Melisande and released his frustration on her instead.
"What in the name of suffering Christ is she doing here?" he demanded of Hook. "Jesus Christ on a cross! Are you turd-witted? Can't be without your woman for a goddamn minute!"
"It was not Nick," Melisande said defiantly. She was holding the crossbow, though she had not shot with it. "It was not Nick," she said again. "And he did tell me to go away."
Sir John's courtesy towards women overcame his anger. He grunted what might have been an apology, and then Melisande was explaining herself, talking in fast French, gesturing towards the camp. And as she spoke, Sir John's face showed a renewed anger. He turned on Hook.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Tell you what, Sir John?"
"That a bastard priest has threatened her."
"I fight my own battles," Hook said sullenly.
"No!"
Sir John thrust a gauntleted hand to strike Hook's shoulder.
"You fight my battles, Hook."
He punched Hook's shoulder again.
"That's what I pay you for. But if you fight mine, then I fight yours. You understand? We are a company."
Sir John shouted the last four words so loudly that men 50 yards down the trench turned to watch him.
"We are a company. No one threatens any one of us without threatening all of us. Your girl should be able to walk naked through the whole army, and not a man will dare touch her because she belongs to us. She belongs to our company. By Christ, I'll kill the holy bastard for this. I'll rip the spine out of his goddamn throat and feed his shriveled prick to the dogs. No one threatens us. No one!"
Sir John, with his real enemies safely back behind their smoke-rimmed ramparts, was looking for a fight, and Hook had just given him one. Hook watched as Melisande spooned honey into Father Christopher's mouth. The priest was sitting, his back supported by a barrel that had come from England filled with smoked herrings. He was skeletally thin, his face was pale and tired, and he was plainly as weak as a fledgling, but he was alive.
"Cobbett's dead," Hook said, "and Robert Fletcher."
"Poor Robert,"
Father Christopher said.
"How's his brother?"
"Still alive," Hook said, "but he's sick."
"Who else?"
"Pearson's dead, Hollis, Borrow and John Taylor."
"God have mercy on them all,"
the priest said, and made the sign of the cross.
"The men-at-arms?"
"John Gaffney, Peter Dance, Sir Thomas Peters," Hook said, "all dead."
"God has turned his face away from us," Father Christopher said bleakly. "Does your saint still speak to you?"
"Not now," Hook admitted.
Father Christopher sighed. He closed his eyes momentarily.
"We have sinned," he said grimly.
"We were told God was on our side," Hook said stubbornly.
"We believed that," the priest said. "We surely believed that, and we came here with that assurance in our hearts. But the French will believe the same thing. And now God is revealing himself. We should not have come here."
"You should not," Melisande said firmly.
"Harfleur will fall," Hook insisted.
"It probably will,"
Father Christopher allowed, then paused as Melisande wiped a trickle of honey from his chin.
"If the French don't march to its relief, yes, it will fall eventually. But what then? How much of the army is left?"
"Enough," Hook said.
Father Christopher offered a tired smile.
"Enough to do what? To march on Rouen and make another siege? To capture Paris? We'll scarce be able to defend ourselves if the French do come here. So what will we do? We'll go into Harfleur and remake its walls and then sail home. We've failed, Hook. We've failed."
Hook sat in silence. One of the remaining English cannons fired, the sound flat and lingering in the warm air. Somewhere in the camp a man sang.
"We can't just go home," he said after a while.
"We can," Father Christopher said. "And we most certainly will. All this money for nothing. For Harfleur, maybe. And what will it cost to rebuild those walls?"
He shrugged.
"Maybe we should abandon the siege," Hook suggested morosely.
The priest shook his head.
"Henry will never do that. He has to win. That way he proves God's favour, and besides, abandoning the siege makes him look weak."
He was silent for a while, then frowned.
"His father took the throne by force, and Henry fears others might do the same if he shows weakness."
"Eat, don't talk,"
Melisande said briskly.
"I've eaten enough, my dear," Father Christopher said.
"You should eat more."
"I will, this evening. Merci."
"God's sparing you, father," Hook said.
"Perhaps he doesn't want me in heaven,"
Father Christopher suggested with a wan smile.
"Or perhaps he is giving me time to become a better priest."
"You are a good priest," Hook said warmly.
I shall tell St. Peter that when he asks if I deserve to be in heaven. Ask Nick Hook, I shall say, and St. Peter will ask me, who is Nick Hook? Oh, I shall say he's a thief, a rogue, and probably a murderer. But ask him anyway.
Hook grinned. I'm honest now, Father.
Thou art not far from the kingdom of heaven, young Hook, but let us hope it's many a long day before we meet there, and at least we'll be spared Sir Martin's company.
Melisande sneered.
He's a coward. Un poltron.
Most men are cowards when they meet Sir John, Father Christopher said mildly.
He had nothing to say, Melisande said.
Sir John had gone to the shelters where Lord Slayton's men were camped. He had taken Hook and Melisande with him, and he had bellowed that any man who wished to kill Hook could do so right there and then.
Come and take his woman, Sir John had shouted. Who wants her?
Lord Slayton's archers, his men-at-arms and his camp followers had been cleaning armour, preparing food or just resting. But all had turned to watch the show. They watched in silence.
Come and take her, Sir John shouted. She's yours! You can take turns like dogs rutting a bitch. Come on, she's a pretty thing. You want to hump her, she's yours.
He waited, but not one of Lord Slayton's men moved. Then Sir John had pointed at Hook.
You can all have her, but first you have to kill my Ventnor.
Still no one moved. No one even met Sir John's eyes.
Which man is being paid to kill you? Sir John had asked Hook.
That one, Hook said, pointing at Tom Peril.
Then come here, Sir John had invited Peril. Come and kill him. I'll give you his woman if you do.
Peril had not moved. He was half hiding behind William Snowball, who as Lord Slayton's steward had some small authority. But Snowball dared not confront Sir John Cornwell.
There is just one thing, Sir John had added, which is that you have to kill both Hook and me before you get the woman. So come on, fight me first.
He'd drawn his sword and waited. No one had moved. No one had spoken. Sir Martin had been watching from behind some men-at-arms.
Is that the priest? Sir John had demanded of Hook.
That's him.
My name is John Cornwell, Sir John had shouted. And some of you know who I am. And Hook is my man. He is my man. He is under my protection, as is this girl.
He had put his free arm around Melisande's shoulders, then pointed his sword blade at Sir Martin.
You, priest, come here!
Sir Martin had not moved.
You can come here, Sir John said, or I can come and fetch you.
Sir Martin, long face twitching, had sidled away from the protective men-at-arms. He looked around as if seeking a place to run, but Sir John had snarled at him to come closer, and he had obeyed.
He's a priest, Sir John had called. So he's a witness to this oath. I swear by this sword and by the bones of St. Credan that if a hair off Hook's head is touched, if he is attacked, if he is wounded, if he is killed, then I shall find you and I shall kill you.
Sir Martin had been peering at Sir John as though he were a curious specimen in a fairground display, a five-legged cow, perhaps, or a woman with a beard. Now still with a puzzled expression, the priest raised both hands to heaven.
Forgive him, Lord. Forgive him, he called. Priest, Sir John began. Knight.
Sir Martin had retorted with surprising force.
The devil rides one horse and Christ the other. You know what that means. I know what this means,
Sir John had held his sword blade towards the priest's throat.
It means that if one of you cabbage-shitting, rat-humping turds touches Hook or his woman, then he will have to reckon with me. And I will tear your farting bowels out of your putrid asses with my bare hands, and I will make you die screaming. I will send your shit-ridden souls to hell. I will kill you.
Silence. Sir John had sheathed his sword, the hilt thumping loud onto the scabbard's throat. He stared at Sir Martin, daring the priest to challenge him, but Sir Martin had drifted away into one of his reveries.
Let's go, Sir John had said.
And when they were out of earshot of the shelters, he'd laughed.
That settled that.
Thank you, Melisande had said, her relief obvious.
Thank me. I enjoyed that, lass.
He probably did enjoy it, Father Christopher said when the tale was told to him. But he'd have enjoyed it more if one of them had offered a fight.
He does love a fight. Who's St. Creedon? Cook asked.
He was a Saxon, Father Christopher said. And when the Normans came, they reckoned he shouldn't be a saint at all because he was a Saxon peasant like you, Hook. So they burned his bones, but the bones turned to gold. Sir John likes him. I have no idea why.
He frowned.
He's not as simple as he likes to pretend.
He's a good man, Hook said.
He probably is, Father Christopher agreed. But don't let him hear you say that.
And you're recovering, Father.
Thanks to God and to your woman, Hook, yes I am.
The priest reached out and took Melisande's hand.
And it's time you made an honest woman of her, Hook.
I am honest, Melisande said.
Then it's time you tamed Master Hook, Father Christopher said.
Melisande looked at Hook, and for a moment her face betrayed nothing. Then she nodded.
Maybe that's why God spared me, Father Christopher said, to marry the two of you. We shall do the deed, young Hook, before we leave France.
And it seemed that must be soon, because Harfleur stood undefeated. The army of England was dying of disease, and the year was inexorably passing. It was already September. In a few weeks the autumn rains would come, and the cold would come, and the harvest would be safely gathered behind fortress walls, and so the campaign season would end. Time was running out. England had gone to war, and she was losing. That evening, Thomas Evelgold tossed a big sack to Hook. Hook jerked aside, thinking the sack would flatten him, but it was surprisingly light and merely rolled off his shoulder.
Toe, Evelgold said in explanation.
Toe?
Toe, Evelgold said. For fire arrows. One sheaf of arrows for each archer. Sir John wants it done by midnight, and we're to be down in the trench before dawn. Belly's boiling pitch for us.
Belly was Andrew Belcher, Sir John's steward, who supervised the kitchen servants and sumpters.
Have you ever made a fire arrow? Evelgold asked.
Never, Hook confessed.
Use the broadheads. Tie a fistful of tow up by the head, dip it in pitch and aim high. We need 2 dozen apiece.
Evelgold carried more sacks to the other groups, while Hook pulled out handfuls of the greasy tow, which was simply clumps of unwashed fleece straight off the sheep's back. A flea jumped from the wool and vanished up his sleeve. He divided the tow into 17 equal sections, and each of his archers divided their share into 24, one lump of fleece for each arrow. Hook cut up some spare bowstrings, and his men used the lengths of cord to bind the bouquets of dirty wool to the arrowheads. Then they lined up by Belly's cauldron to dip the tow into the boiling pitch. They propped the arrows upright against tree stumps or barrels to let the sticky pitch solidify.
What's happening in the dawn? Hook asked Evelgold.
The French kicked our arses this morning, Evelgold said grimly. So we have to kick theirs tomorrow morning.
He shrugged as if he did not expect to achieve much.
You lose any more men today?
Cobbett and Fletch. Matson can't last long. Evelgold swore.
Good men, he said grimly. And dying for what? He spat towards a campfire. When the pitch is dry, he went on, tease it out a bit. It lets it catch the fire easier.
The camp was restless all night. Men were carrying faggots to the forward trench nearest to the enemy's barbican. The faggots were great bundles of wood bound with rope, and the sight of them made it clear enough what was intended at dawn. A flooded ditch protected the barbican, and it would need to be filled if men were to cross and assault the battered fortress. Sir John's men-at-arms were ordered to put on full armour. 30 men-at-arms had sailed from Southampton Water on the day the Swans had flown low through the fleet to signify good fortune, but only 19 were now fit to serve. 6 had died. The other 5 were vomiting and shitting and shivering. The fit men-at-arms were being helped by squires and pages who buckled plates of armour over padded leather jerkins that had been wiped with grease so the shrouding metal would move easily. Sword belts were strapped over jupons, though most men-at-arms chose to carry poleaxes or shortened lances. A priest from Sir William Porter's household heard confessions and gave blessings. Sir William was Sir John's closest friend and also his brother-in-arms, which meant they fought side by side and had sworn to protect each other, to ransom each other if, by misfortune, either were taken prisoner, and to protect the other man's widow if either were to die. Sir William was a studious-looking man, thin-faced and pale-eyed. His hair, before he hid it with a snout-visored helm, was thinning. He seemed out of place in armour, as though his natural home was a library or perhaps a courtroom. But he was Sir John's chosen battle companion, and that spoke volumes about his courage. He adjusted his helmet and pushed up the visor before nodding a nervous greeting to Sir John's archers. Those archers were armoured and armed. Most men, like Hook, wore a padded harbergeon sewn with metal plates over a mail coat. They had helmets and a few had aventails, the hood of mail that was worn beneath the helmet and fell across the shoulders. Their bow arms were protected by braces. They wore swords and carried 3 arrow bags, 2 of which contained the tow-headed fire arrows. Some chose to carry an axe as well as a bow, but most, like Hook, preferred the poleaxe. All the men, whether lords, knights, men-at-arms or archers, wore the Red Cross of St. George on their jupons.
"God be with you,"
Sir William saluted the archers, who murmured a dutiful response.
"And the devil take the French," Sir John called as he strode from his tent. He was in a high mood, the prospect of action giving his eyes a gleam.
"It's a simple enough job this morning," he said dismissively. "We just have to take the barbican away from the bastards. Let's do it before breakfast."
Melisande had given Hook a lump cut from a flitch of bacon and a piece of bread, which he ate as Sir John's company filed downhill towards the siege works. It was still dark. The wind was brisk and cool from the east, bringing the scent of the salt marshes to cut the cloying smell of the dead. The arrows clattered in their bags as the archers followed the winding paths. Fires glowed in the siege lines, and on the defences of Harfleur, where Hook knew the garrison would be repairing the damage done during the previous day.
"God bless you," a priest called as the bowmen filed past. "God be with you. God preserve you."
The French must have sensed something evil was brewing, for they used a pair of catapults to lob 2 light carcasses across the ramparts. The carcasses were great balls of cloth and tinder, soaked in pitch and sulphur, and they wheeled and sparked as they arced through the night sky, then fell in a great gout of flame that burst bright when the wicker-strapped balls landed. The firelight reflected off helmets in the English trenches, and those gleams provoked the crossbowmen on the walls to start shooting. The bolts whispered overhead or thumped into the parapets. Insults were shouted from the walls, but the shouts were half-hearted, as though the garrison was tired and uncertain. The English trench was crowded. The archers with the fire arrows were ordered to the front, and behind them more archers waited with bundles of faggots. Sir John Holland, the king's nephew, was in charge of the attack, though again, as when he had led the scouting party ashore before the invasion, he was accompanied by his stepfather, Sir John Cornwell.
"When I give the command," the younger Sir John said, "the archers will loose fire arrows at the barbican. We want to set it alight."
Iron braziers had been placed every few yards along the trench. They were heaped with burning sea coal that gave off pungent fumes.
"Drown them with fire," Sir John Holland urged the archers. "Smoke them out like rats. And when they're blinded by smoke, we fill in the ditch and take the barbican by assault."
He made it sound easy. The remaining English guns had been loaded with stones coated with pitch. The Dutch gunners waited, their linstocks glowing. Dawn seemed to take forever. The defenders got tired of shooting crossbow bolts, and their insults with their bolts faded away. Both sides waited. A cockerel crowed in the camp, and soon a score of birds was calling. Page boys carrying spare sheaves of arrows waited in the saps behind the trench, where priests were saying mass and hearing confessions. Men took it in turns to kneel and receive the wafers along with God's blessing.
"Your sins are forgiven," a priest murmured to Hook, who hoped it was true.
He had not confessed to Robert Peril's murder, and as he took the host, he wondered if that deception would condemn him. He almost blurted out his guilt, but the priest was already gesturing the next man forward, so Hook stood and moved away. The wafer stuck to his palate, and he said a sudden silent prayer to St. Crispinian. Did Harfleur have a guardian saint, he wondered, and was that saint beseeching God to kill the English? A stir in the trench made Hook turn to see the king edging through the crowded ranks. He wore full battle armour, though he had yet to pull on his helmet. His breast and back plates were covered with a surcoat on which the royal arms were blazoned bright, crossed by the Red Cross of St. George. The king carried a broad-bladed war axe as well as his sheathed sword. He had no shield, but nor did any other knight or man-at-arms. Their plate armour was protection enough, and iron-bound shields were a relic of olden days. The king nodded companionably to the archers.
Take the barbican, he said as he walked along the trench, and the city must surely fall. God be with you.
He repeated the phrases as he worked his way along the trench, followed by a squire and two men-at-arms.
I shall go with you, he said as he neared Hook. If God wants me to rule France, then he will protect us. God be with you, and keep me company, fellows, as we take back what is rightfully ours.
String your bows, Sir John Holland said when the king had gone past. Won't be long now.
Hook braced one end of his big bow against his right foot and bent it so that he could loop the string about the upper nock.
Shoot high with the fire arrows, Thomas Evergold growled. You can't do a full draw or you'll scorch your hand, so shoot high and make sure the pitch is well alight before you loose.
The grey light seeped brighter. Hook, gazing between two gabions of the battered parapet, could see that the barbican was a wreck. Its great iron-bound timbers that had once formed such a formidable wall had been broken and driven in by gunfire, yet the enemy had patched the gaps with more timbers so that the whole outlying fort now resembled an ugly hill studded with wooden bulks. The summit, which had once stood close to 40 feet high, was half that now, yet it was still a formidable obstacle. The face was steep, the ditch deep, and there was room at the top for 40 or 50 crossbowmen and men-at-arms. Banners hung down the ruined face, displaying saints and coats of arms. Once in a while a helmeted face would peer past a timber as the men on the ragged top watched for the expected assault.
You start shooting your fire arrows when the guns fire, Sir John Cornwell reminded his men. That's the signal. Shoot steadily. If you see a man trying to extinguish the fires, kill the bastard.
The coals in the nearest brazier shifted, provoking a spurt of light and a galaxy of sparks. A page crouched beside the iron basket with a handful of kindling that he would pile on the coals to make the flames to light the pitch-soaked arrows. Gulls wheeled and flocked above the salt marsh, where the bodies of the dead were thrown into the tidal creeks. The gulls of Normandy were getting fat on English dead. The wafer was still stuck in Hook's dry mouth.
Any moment now, Sir William Porter said, as though that would be a comfort to the waiting men.
There was a creaking sound, and Hook turned to his left to see the men turning the windlass that lifted the tilting screen in front of the nearest gun. The French saw it too, and a springalt bolt whipped from the ramparts to thump into the lifting screen. A gunner pulled a gabion away from the cannon's black mouth, and the gun fired. The pitch that coated the stone had caught fire from the powder's explosion, so that the gunstone looked like a sear of dull light as it whipped from the smoke to flash across the broken ground and crash into the barbican.
Now!
Sir John Holland called, and the page piled the kindling into the coals so that bright flames burst from the brazier.
Don't let the arrows touch each other,
Evergold advised as the archers held the first missiles in the newly roused fire. More guns fired. A timber on the barbican shattered and a spill of earth scumbled down the steep face. Hook waited till his pitch bouquet was well alight, then placed the arrow on the string. He feared the ash shaft would burn through, so he hauled fast, winced as the flames burned his left hand, aimed high and released quickly. Other fire arrows were already arcing towards the barbican, their flight slow and awkward. His own arrow leaped off the string and trailed sparks as it fluttered. It fell short. Other arrows were thumping into the splintered timbers of the barbican. The cannon smoke drifted like a screen between the archers and their target.
Keep shooting, Sir John Holland called.
Hook took the rag he used to wax his bow from a pouch and wrapped it about his left hand to protect himself from the flames. His second arrow flew true, striking one of the broken bulks of wood. The burning missiles curved through the early light in showers of fire, and the barbican was already dotted with small flames as more and more arrows fell. Hook saw defenders moving on the makeshift rampart and guessed they were pouring water or earth down the barbican's face, and so he took a broadhead and shot it fast and true. Then he loosed his last fire arrow and saw that the flames were spreading and smoke was writhing from the broken barbican in 100 places. One of the banners was alight, its linen flaring sudden and bright. He loosed 3 more broadheads at the ramparts, and just then a trumpet called from a few yards down the trench, and the men carrying the bundled faggots pushed past him, climbed the parapet and ran forward.
After them, Sir John Holland shouted. Give them arrows.
The archers and men-at-arms scrambled from the trench. Now Hook could shoot over the heads of the men in front, aiming at the crossbowmen who suddenly crowded the barbican's smoke-wreathed parapet.
"Arrows!"
he bellowed, and a page brought him a fresh bag. He was shooting instinctively now, sending bodkin after bodkin at the defenders, who were little more than shadows in the thickening smoke. There were shouts from the ditch's edge. Men were dying there, but their faggots were filling the deep hole.
"For Harry and St. George," Sir John Cornwell bellowed. "Standard-bearer?"
"I'm here,"
a squire given the task of carrying Sir John's banner called back.
"Forward!"
The men-at-arms went with Sir John, shouting as they advanced over the uneven, broken and scorched ground. The archers came behind. The trumpet still sounded. Other men were advancing to the left and right. The bowmen who had filled the ditch had run to either side and were now shooting arrows up at the rampart. Crossbow bolts smacked into men. One of Sir John's men opened his mouth suddenly, clutched his belly, and without a sound doubled over and fell. Another man-at-arms, the son of an earl, had blood dripping from his helmet and a bolt sticking from his open visor. He staggered, then fell to his knees. He shook off Hook's helping hand, and with the bolt still in his shattered face, managed to stand and run forward again.
End of Disc 6.